Okay, so the topic for today's Hanukkah Shir is to speak about two recitations which are customarily said following the lighting of the menorah. We know that prior to lighting the menorah itself, there are two or three brachos which are recited. L'hadlik ner shel Chanukah, or L'hadlik ner Chanukah, depending on how you say it. Sh'asa nisim l'avoseinu, those who recite on all of the nights of Chanukah. Now, the first night of Chanukah, of course, as we know, there's the brach of Shechianu, which is recited prior to the lighting of the candles. Those brachos are mentioned in the Gemara and are mandated by the letter of the law, by Halacha. The two recitations which we're going to talk about today, namely Haneros Halalu and Ma'os Tzur, are not mentioned in the Gemara itself. They're, in the case of Haneros, well, we'll see. In each case, the failure to say Haneros Halalu or Ma'os Tzur does not interfere with the performance of the mitzvah. You still did what you had to do, even if you omitted these recitations. Nonetheless, we'll see that as we look at these recitations, Haneros Halalu and Ma'os Tzur, they shed quite a bit of light, I guess pun only mildly intended, they shed quite a bit of light on the foundations of Hanukkah, what the menorah is supposed to be all about, and by going through them, perhaps we'll have a better appreciation of what they're telling us, when we recite them following the kindling of the menorah. So let's start with Haneros Halalu, which is a far more ancient recitation than Ma'os Tzur. Haneros Halalu is referenced already in the Masechet Sofrim. And the Masechet Sofrim is a source which we spoke about a few weeks ago in a different context. It's one of the so-called Masechtos Ketanos, the minor tractates, which are printed in the volumes of the Gemara together with the traditional Gemara. It's not really part of the Gemara. It's presented in the same style as the Mishnah is, and it quotes a lot of the same rabbis as the rabbis of the Mishnah. But it himself was compiled sometime during the early Middle Ages. Nonetheless, that still makes it a very, very ancient and authentic source for Jewish practice, and many of the customs which we have today, especially when it comes to issues of tefillah and different aspects of davening, are rooted in the Masechet Sofrim. So Haneros Halalu is mentioned in the Masechet Sofrim as a paragraph which is supposed to be recited after the Hanukkah menorah has been lit. There are two schools of thought as to exactly when you're supposed to say Haneros Halalu. And in the end of the day, it's all good, whatever you do, but just you should be aware of the fact that there are these two schools of thought. One school of thought says that you should start reciting Haneros Halalu after you've kindled the first candle. So in other words, let's say it's the eighth night of Hanukkah, you kindle the first candle, and then you start saying Haneros Halalu. Why? Well, the argument goes as follows. The first candle is really the essential mitzvah. You know, the Gemara tells us, that we don't know, but now we're going to know, the Gemara tells us that the mitzvah of Hanukkah is really just to light one candle each night of Hanukkah. We have a practice which has become standard that we add another light each night of Hanukkah to indicate what night of Hanukkah it is. But strictly speaking, that's what's called the Hiddur mitzvah. That's an embellishment of the mitzvah. The mitzvah itself is to light a single candle. The bare bones mitzvah is to light a single candle every night of Hanukkah. If you got stuck for whatever reason, you found yourself in some far-flung place where you can only get a single candle, and it's the seventh night of Hanukkah, light that single candle. You will be in performance of the basic mitzvah of Hanukkah lights, even by just lighting a single candle. Also, one second. So, one school of thought is, you say Haneros Halalu after you've lit the first candle, and as you're lighting the subsequent candles. The bracha l'hadlik ner? Yeah, no, so all those brachas you say before you start lighting. But the general practice is, the basic idea for the Gemara is that a bracha is supposed to be recited before the performance of the mitzvah. Again, there's some exceptions to that, but you know, most of the time the bracha is recited before the performance of the mitzvah. Haneros halol is not a bracha. Haneros halol, as we'll see in just a moment, is a declaration of the purpose of these lights and what they're supposed to teach us. So one school of thought is you light one candle so that you can do the mitzvah itself, the real mitzvah, right after making the brachos. But now, as you're lighting the additional lights, which are hinder mitzvah, which are a beautification of the mitzvah, that already you can start saying Haneros Halalu. Another school of thought says just light all the lights and, you know, do everything you have to do, and then you can say Haneros Halalu. Again, it's good either way. So, because we're pointing out the two schools of thought on this issue. What does Haneros Halalu actually say? So, let's just read it briefly. I have a sitter in front of me. If you want to look at a sitter, it's 782 in the article of Siddurim. If not, I'll read it slowly and just translate. The paragraph says, Haneros Halalu anachnu maglikim. These candles which we are lighting are al hanisim v'al hanislos, al hashuos v'al hamelchamos. They commemorate the miracles, the wonders, the salvations, and the battles that you, God, did for our forefathers during these days at this time, through your holy Kohanim, your holy priests. Throughout the 8 days of Hanukkah, these candles are holy. We have no permission to utilize them. We're only allowed to look at them. In order to express thanks and praise to your great name, for your miracles, your wonders, and your salvations. In other words, this paragraph is a statement of why it is that we're lighting the Hanukkah candles. It's to remind us of the miracles. It tells us a little bit, there's one halacha about the Hanukkah candles that we're told, namely, that we're not allowed to use it for any other purpose, which is that we can look at it, but we're not supposed to read by its light or utilize it in any other way. And these thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for all of the miracles that you did to us, that you did for us. To some extent, the purpose of Haneros Halalu is to engage in an act of Pirsumei Nisa, of publicizing the miracle, because think about the following. Again, for us, you know, we use electricity, so if we're going to be lighting candles, whether of wax or oil or whatever, you know, it's clearly a deviation from the norm and can only be for some, you know, ritual purpose. But in the day and age when people were lighting candles all the time, lighting candles, you know, as it began to get dark at night, wasn't necessarily a sign that it was being lit for the purpose of Hanukkah. How could I display that what I'm lighting is for the purpose of Hanukkah? And again, remember, even though we have all kinds of fancy menorahs and all of that, the mitzvah doesn't really require a menorah. I think I mentioned over Shabbos a bunch of people. I had a chavrusa in yeshiva who used to make his menorah every year out of empty beer bottles. You know, Baruch Hashem, by the time Hanukkah was over, he was quite happy. You know, so, okay. But, you know, you can take tea lights, you know, you can, on the seventh night of Hanukkah, you can take seven tea lights and line them up in a row and light them. It doesn't have to be a fancy menorah, you know, with, you know, made out of silver or anything like that. You know, you just have to kindle a certain number of lights. So, in a day and age before electricity, how do we know that what you're lighting is actually for the purpose of Hanukkah? Reciting this paragraph, Haneros Halalu, is a way of declaring that what I'm doing is lighting Hanukkah candles, and that is a form of Pirsumei Nisa, publicizing the miracle in its own right. The poskim point out that there are certain hints in Haneros Halalu, you know, even in the way the structure, the way Haneros Halalu is set up. First of all, the two words Haneros Halalu consist of eight letters in total. And I have to spell Haneros without the Vav. If you spell Haneros without the Vav, which is the way it's spelled traditionally, Haneros Halalu is exactly eight letters. Good. So that's the 8 days of Hanukkah. The number of words after Haneros Halalu, in other words, from Anachnu Madlikim, if you count them, are exactly 36 words. And there are 36 candles which are kindled over the course of Hanukkah. So, you know, even the way the paragraph is set up, it's set up in a way so that it hints first to the 8 days of Hanukkah and then to the 36 candles which are going to be kindled over the course of Hanukkah. There are hints, you know, even in the structure of the paragraph. Let's take a look a little bit at the substance of the paragraph, and we'll see that there are, you know, some very noteworthy things in the paragraph itself. The paragraph refers twice to niflaos, wonders, which we have to give thanks for. Haneros halalu anachem adlikim, ala nisim v'al haniflaos. And then we say a little bit later on that the purpose of these lights is lahodos v'lahalo l'shimcha agogo, al nisecha v'al nisloosecha, that we give thanks again for the niflaos, for the wonders, which were performed by the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Sfarshim Chazal pointed out that the somewhat parallel passage to Haneros Halalu, Al Hanisim, which we say during davening and benching, makes reference also to a lot of things which were performed by God on our behalf, but at least in Nusach Ashkenaz, does not have the word Niflaos. Right? Al Hanisim, V'al HaPurkon, V'al HaGvuros, V'al HaChuos, V'al HaMilchomos. Again, the Sfar they added Al HaNiflaos, but Nusach Ashkenaz, there's no reference to Niflaos and Al HaNisim. The Sfarshim said that omission, in other words, the fact that in Al HaNisim, in davening and benching, we only speak about Nisim, about miracles, whereas in Haneros Halalu we speak about Niflaos, wonders, that difference is a significant difference. How so? The Sfar of Sfarshim is as follows. A nes, nisim, referred to incredible events that can be explained as part of the regular course of nature. So if you read the paragraph, B'nei Matisyahu, which describes the miracle of Hanukkah, you know, the paragraph which we say during benching and davening, it focuses exclusively on the military victory which the Jews achieved against the Syrian Greeks. Again, you go through the paragraph, it basically says, you know, they made decrees against us, we were outnumbered, we fought against them, we won, we came into the Beit HaMikdash, we rededicated it, and everything was great. There is no reference in the Al HaNisim paragraph to the miracle of the oil, which so many of us know is, the most common story which we associate with the story of Hanukkah. Parenthetically, there's one line in B'nei Matisyahu in Al HaNisim that sounds like it's talking about the miracle of the oil, but when you read it a little bit more carefully, it's really not. In that paragraph, we say the Achakim Baal of Bonechol Izir Beisecha. After the miracle, your sons, your children, came into your sanctuary. The Hidliku Neiros Bechatzos Kodshecha, and they lit lights in your holy courtyards. So when you read that, you think, oh, they lit lights in your holy courtyards. Oh, that's the story with the menorah. You know, they came in, they lit the menorah, and the oil burned for 8 days. So first of all, there's no reference in the Siddur to the oil burning 8 days. They came in, they lit lights. You know, you wouldn't know that anything miraculous happened based on that line. But the commentaries point out, it's also pretty clear that line is actually not talking about the menorah. Because where was the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash? It was near the Kodesh HaKodashim. It was, you know, in the holy area right before you went into the Holy of Holies. It was inside the building of the Beit HaMikdash, pretty deep inside that building. The tefillah of Al HaNisim speaks about the Maccabees lighting lights in your holy courtyards. So the menorah wasn't kindled in the courtyard, it was kindled in the building of the Beit HaMikdash. So clearly that line is referring to something else. It's just saying that, you know, the Jews were happy when they had this military victory against the Syrian Greeks. So they lit lights, you know, all over the place to commemorate the miracle. But it's not a reference to the lighting of the menorah because the location is wrong. You know, the location is not the location where the menorah was actually located. So, in other words, Al HaNisim makes no reference to the miracle of the lighting of the menorah and the oil and all of that whatsoever. It's all about the military victory. Now, was the military victory miraculous? Absolutely. But was it miraculous in a supernatural way? In other words, did God bend the laws of nature to bring about that miracle? Not really. But, you know, it was an example of a miracle, which is a miracle that functions through the laws of nature. Instead of salvation, that's a nace. When we talk about nisim, miracles in that context means miracles that can be explained within the context of nature. In contrast, the Rasulavetchik nislaos, wonders, refer to miracles that defy nature, that are supernatural. In the paragraph of Haneros Halola, which is said after we kindle the menorah, which reminds us in the most direct fashion of the miracle of the oil in the Beis HaMikdash, there we talk about how God not only did for us nisim, miracles that are within the context of nature, but he also performs for us niflos, miracles that defy the normal laws of nature. That's Haneros Halalu Anachnu Madlikim, Al HaNisim V'Al HaNiflos. We're giving thanks to the miracles within nature, and we're giving thanks to the miracles that are supernatural. And a little bit later, L'Hodosu L'Halu L'Shimcha Agadol, we want to thank and praise your great name, Al Nisecha, for your miracles and for your wonders, for the natural miracles and for the supernatural miracles. And again, it makes sense to mention the supernatural miracles when we're doing something, lighting the menorah, which is the most direct expression of that miracle of the oil, which, you know, again, clearly was a supernatural miracle which took place in the Beis HaMikdash. Something also which is striking in the paragraph of Haneros Halalu. So we state during the paragraph of Haneros Halalu that Haneros Halalu Kodesh Hein. These lights are holy. Ve'ein lanu rishus lehishtamesh bohem. And we have no right to use them for our own purposes. You know, we can't do anything with the lights. Elo lirosom bilvad. The only thing we can do with them is to look at them. So the Soleshik here also pointed out that in a very subtle way, the Masechet Sofrim is taking sides in a dispute among the medieval authorities in trying to explain a certain halacha. The Gemara says that you're not allowed to make use of the lights of the Hanukkah menorah for any purpose. You can't use them in any way. Of course, we know that's why we light the Shamas. Right? In other words, the Shamas is there so that there should be some secular light, some non-sacred light in the room, you know, while the candles are burning. So this way, if you happen to, you know, to read something, and, you know, arguably you're reading by the light of the candles, you can always say, well, I'm not reading by the light of the candles, I'm reading by the light of the Shamas. Right? So there's some other light there so that you're not making use of the candles in an inappropriate way. So why is it inappropriate, why is it usher to use the candles for some purpose, for some other purpose? Why does the Gemara prohibit that? So there are two schools of thought among the medieval authorities. One school of thought is that this is just our way of showing that the candles were lit for the purpose of Hanukkah. In other words, if I could just light, again, go back to a pre-electric age where people have candles of all sorts all around the house on all occasions. So if I'm just going to light candles and then pull out the newspaper and just read by the light of the candles, so how do I know that these are Hanukkah candles? I mean, they're just like regular candles, right? To show that they're Hanukkah candles, I have to not do anything with them. And that's a way of showing that they're Hanukkah candles. That's the whole idea behind not utilizing the candles for any other purpose. But there's a second school of thought that says, no, it's much more than that. In a rabbinic sense, the rabbis said that the candles which we light during Hanukkah take on the properties of the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, you know, the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash was a sacred item, and you couldn't use it for any other purposes the same way that you couldn't use anything in the Beis HaMikdash for secular purposes. In other words, you know, if you wander into the Beis HaMikdash one day and you see a cup that's dedicated for the service of the Beis HaMikdash, you say, oh, you know, I'm thirsty, you know, maybe I'll just you know, take a drink out of this cup was a Beis HaMikdash. So that's a very serious prohibition. I mean, the person has to bring a carbon called Me'ilah. You know, making improper use of the holy vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, you would have to bring a carbon. You have to bring a sacrifice to atone for that sin of utilizing something sacred for secular purposes. So certainly if I was in the Beis HaMikdash and the menorah was burning, I couldn't pull out my newspaper and just read it by the light of the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash, because that would be an improper use of a sacred object. The second school of thought says, when the rabbis created the law of lighting the menorah in our houses, they wanted not only to commemorate the miracle of Hanukkah, but they wanted the very mitzvah of the menorah itself, the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash, to be transferred on some level into our homes. Right? That what we light is in some ways a continuation of that menorah of the Beis HaMikdash. And one way in which they did it is they said you can't utilize the candles for any purpose the same way that the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash couldn't be used for any purpose. If you look at the text of the Haneros HaLolu, it seems like the Haneros HaLolu embraces that second way of understanding the nature of the prohibition to gain benefit from the candles of the menorah. Kol Shmonas Yimei Hanukkah, all 8 days of Hanukkah, Haneros HaLolu Kodesh Hem. These candles are holy. It's not just that you can't utilize them, they are holy. They are a direct continuation of the sanctity that was invested in the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. So this paragraph of Haneros HaLolu is really telling us between the lines that when we light the menorah in our homes, we are in some, you know, not in a full way, but in some way rabbinically perpetuating the mitzvah of lighting the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. We're transforming our homes, at least for that short period of time, into a miniature Beis HaMikdash and carrying forward that concept of kindling the menorah, which had been restricted to Beis HaMikdash. We're now able to light it in our own homes. Right? So that idea, which if you think that is a very powerful idea, is was contained within the text of Haneros HaLolu. I want to shift gears a little bit and speak about Maoz Tzur. Yeah?
I thought this at the beginning there were two.
And then Maoz Tzur. So that's recitation number two. So that's here, right. So Maoz Tzur is even less ancient than Haneros HaLolu. But again, Haneros HaLolu, we pointed out, as already mentioned, Masech HaSofrim, Shulchan Aruch mentions the recitation of Haneros HaLolu. And again, you know, although it's true that if you omit Haneros HaLolu, you still fulfill the mitzvah. It's not a fundamental part of the kindling, but, you know, the idea of saying Haneros HaLolu is a pretty well-entrenched practice, you know, that goes back centuries and, you know, is a good and proper thing to do. Maoz Tzur is a nice song, you know, a nice zemer, so to speak, and while it's certainly a nice thing to sing, it doesn't have that same, you know, tradition and rootedness that Haneros HaLolu has. Nonetheless, Maoz Tzur does seem to go back centuries. I don't know if we know too much about, you know, the exact time it was composed or its authorship. We know that it was authored by somebody whose name was Mordechai. We know that because if you read the stanzas, there's an acrostic that spells out the name Mordechai, you know, from stanza to stanza. Maoz Tzur Yishalosi, Roz Tzav Anashi, Dvir Kodsho, Kroz Yerbamin, spells out Mordechai. Okay, so some, that narrows it down, right? I guess we go through history, we know that the person who wrote it must have been named Mordechai, so that, you know, clearly narrows it down to anyone who wasn't named Mordechai. Okay, so we've gotten a little bit closer to figuring out who it was. It's also very interesting. I think every group within Ashkenazi Jews has the same tune for Maoz Tzur. You know, the traditional tune for Maoz Tzur that everybody sings. I think that's one of those tunes that is just, to the best of my knowledge, pretty universal. I'm always hesitant to say that anything is universal because everybody always has a slightly different way of doing things. But across the spectrum, everybody seems to have the same tune for Maoz Tzur, so I guess it's just like a nice Achdus or unity thing that everybody, at least in this regard, happens to be together. What's the theme of Maoz Tzur? So Lal Sur describes the various exiles that the Jewish people have been subjected to. In turn, it speaks about our exile in Egypt, our exile in Babylonia, our exile in Persia, and how we were threatened by Haman, and ultimately he was hung. The exile of the Greeks, in other words, all of the events that surrounded the story of Hanukkah. And the last paragraph looks to the future and says, essentially, we are now in the last exile, the exile of Edom, the exile of Rome, where we're still considered to be under the thumb of the Roman Empire and its descendants in some way. So topple that last empire and bring about the final redemption. And this last paragraph that talks about toppling the final empire and bringing about the final redemption was understood probably correctly by the Christian church as being a knock at the Christian church. I've heard say that it was a knock at the Crusaders specifically. If you look at the very last line, the very last line says, "Dechei Admon, push aside the red one." The red one, of course, is the reference to Esav, right? Esav is the ancestor of Edom. Again, Edom is associated with Rome and, Christendom, essentially. The sailed Salomon. It's a very strange term. The sailed Salomon. So in article, they translate that to nethermost shadow. Push aside the red one in the nethermost shadow. What does that mean? I'm not even sure what nethermost means altogether. So some commentaries point out the word Salomon is actually very similar to the word Salem, which, of course, means the cross. And Dechei Admon Betzel Salomon can be understood as meaning push aside those red ones who walk in the shadow of the cross. Of course, the Crusaders took the cross with them as they made their way across Europe, again, among other things, massacring many Jews. So this could be understood in a sort of very subtle and, between the lines kind of way of saying, Ribbono Shel Olam, you got rid of the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks. Why don't we get rid of the Crusaders as well, and get rid of them, right? Now, again, if the church figured that out also, you could understand why that would be, subject this last paragraph to a lot of, to a lot of censorship. But again, the church censored much of Jewish literature, during the course of the Middle Ages. But that could be the reference in this last line. The Chei Admon, the Tzel Salmon, push aside the red one who goes in the shadow of the cross, not the nethermost shadow, he goes in the shadow of the cross, push aside this red one, and clear the way. Hakim Lanu Roim Shiva, bring the seven shepherds, who, as the Gemara talks about in Sukkah, are those seven great figures in Jewish history who will be responsible for ushering in the age of Moshiach, the Messianic era. Right? But that is certainly the theme of Ma'ol Tzur. We suffered throughout all of the years. We're looking forward to the ending, the same way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu ended all of our previous sins in exile, all of the various oppressors of the Jewish people who rose up against us. Get rid of this last exile as well, and the oppressor who is oppressing us even at the current time. I wanted to focus a little bit on the very first paragraph of Ma'ol Tzur. That's the one that most of us know best, after the first stanza, like most songs, we get a little bit fuzzy as to the words exactly. But, the first stanza of Ma'ol Tzur, so people tend to know. And to just point out one or two things that are implicit in the stanza that we may not have thought about, but I think once we learn them, we'll see that, the ideas are very much there. Ma'ol Tzur Yeshuasi, Almighty Rock of my salvation, this is reading the article translation, L'cha na'e l'shabeach. It is appropriate to praise you. Tikkun Beis Tfilasi, restore my house of prayer. In other words, bring back the Beis HaMikdash, which is now destroyed. Bisham Todon is Abeach. And then we will offer up a thanksgiving offering. The time will come when you will prepare a slaughterhouse from the enemy who comes and barks at us. Right? In other words, God, you're going to bring vengeance upon the enemies who are, again, barking is a euphemism over here. You know, in this case, the enemy's bite is worse than his bark. You know, the enemy is coming and barking and doing all kinds of terrible things to us. When you get rid of them, Oz Egmar, Bishir Mizmar, Chanukah Samizdeach, then I will complete with a song of him, the dedication of the altar. So one word I want to focus on for the next couple of moments is the word Egmar, I will complete. Right? Because when the enemy is finally defeated, and presumably the third Beit HaMikdash is built, at that time I will finish, I will complete the dedication of the altar. If you think about it, that choice of word is very striking. What do you mean, I will complete it? I will engage him. In other words, I will dedicate. I will dedicate the Mizbeach, the altar. I will dedicate the Beit HaMikdash. What do you mean, I'm going to finish the dedication of the altar? So in this one word, and again, this is based on Torah from a Soloveitchik, as filtered through one of his preeminent Talmidim, my Rebbe, Rav Heschel Shechter. Implicit in this one word, Egmar, is a tremendous idea about the connection between the second Beit HaMikdash and the ultimate third Beit HaMikdash. Consider the following. There's a halacha that the first day a Kohen performs his service in the Beit HaMikdash, he has to bring a certain kind of flower offering. It's actually referred to as the Minchas Chinuch. Most people, when they hear the word Minchas Chinuch, no, Sefer. Sefer called the Minchas Chinuch, you know, the dedication flower offering. But before it was a Sefer, it was a concept. Right? The concept of the Minchas Chinuch is you're a Kohen who's serving for the first time in the Beit HaMikdash, but you have an inaugural offering, a flower offering, basically to, you know, inaugurate your new term of service in the Beit HaMikdash. We know historically there were Kohanim who served in both the first Beit HaMikdash as well as in the second Beit HaMikdash. Right? Again, there were only 70 years between the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash and the second Beit HaMikdash. So again, we know from the Psukim in Tanakh that, you know, there were people who were old enough, people lived longer than 70 years, so there were people who were old enough to remember, you know, the first Beit HaMikdash, and they lived into the dedication of the second. Let's say, theoretically, and it may not have been theoretical, this may have applied to people, you had a Kohen who was very young at the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, and he had already begun serving. Then the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and then 70 years later, the second Beit HaMikdash is built. This Kohen is still, you know, ready for service. So he wants to resume bringing his, you know, doing his service as a Kohen in the second Beit HaMikdash. The halacha is that he has to bring another Minchas Chinuch when he begins serving in the second Beit HaMikdash. Why? I mean, he started his term as a Kohen. Okay, so he just went on vacation for 70 years, right? So, okay, so long vacation. Some people have a very good job, you know, they just get a lot of vacation days. So, but, you know, why should he have to bring another Minchas Chinuch? He already started serving. So the answer is that the second Beit HaMikdash is not a continuation of the first Beit HaMikdash. It's a new institution. Right? The Pasuk says, we know in Tehillim, that the Edomites, the Edomim, said concerning the first Beit HaMikdash, Aru, Aru, Ad HaYisod Ba, chip away at it until you reach the foundations of the first Beit HaMikdash. Rip the whole thing out from the foundations. So when the second Beit HaMikdash was built, it was a totally, you know, new institution which was not connected to the first. And the manifestation of that is that a Kohen, even one who had served in the first Beit HaMikdash, was considered to be starting over again when he began his term of service in the second Beis HaMikdash. The relationship between the second Beis HaMikdash and the ultimate third Beis HaMikdash is a different type of relationship. Again, it's not physically possible for someone to have served in the second and to serve in the third, again, barring Tchiyas HaNeisim, right? But, you know, so in other words, the specific manifestation of the person having to bring another Minchas Chinuch isn't relevant. But in theory, if somebody were to live a very, 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 very long time and would have served in the second Beis HaMikdash and still be around when the third Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt, that person would not have to bring another Minchas Chinuch. Because conceptually, the second Beis HaMikdash is viewed as laying the groundwork for the third. That idea comes through in a fascinating series of psukim in the book of Haggai. Just FYI, there is a book of Haggai. It's in Tanakh. It's one of the Sayasar. And the Navi Haggai prophesies at the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash period. Very short sefer. It's two chapters long. So the Navi Haggai is addressing Jewish people who are, you know, rededicating the second Beis HaMikdash after having come back from the Babylonian exile, and they're depressed. Why are they depressed? Because basically the second Beis HaMikdash was a pale facsimile of the first Beis HaMikdash. It was not as beautiful. You know, they were missing certain things. You know, there was no Aron in the second Beis HaMikdash, there were no Urim V'Tumim in the second Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara Masechta Yuma lists off five different things that were absent from the second Beis HaMikdash. And basically, you know, the Jews at that time felt, okay, you know, this is nice, but, you know, it's not the real deal. So the Navi Haggai is looking to reassure the Jewish people of that time. And he says in Perek Beis Pasuk Vav, Yichol Amar Hashem Tzvakos, Thus says Hashem, just wait a little bit. I'm going to cause the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land to tremble, says Hashem. I'm going to cause all of the nations to tremble. The glory of all of the nations will be brought to Yerushalayim. Says Hashem, I will fill up this second Beis HaMikdash with my glory. I promise you, says Hashem, the glory of this second Beis HaMikdash is going to be even greater than the glory of the first Beis HaMikdash. Okay? So, what's that all about? Writes Rashi on Sefer Haggai that this is a reference to the miracles of Hanukkah. That God is going to do something during the second Beis HaMikdash period to shake the heavens and the earth, and this is going to show everyone that the glory of the second Beis HaMikdash is even going to be bigger than the glory of the first Beis HaMikdash. Okay, so what does that mean? Right? In other words, what is it about the story of Hanukkah that illustrates to the Jews and reassures them that, you know, this is the second Beis HaMikdash? Not only is it not a second-rate Beis HaMikdash, it's actually even more glorious and more beautiful than the first Beis HaMikdash. So explain Mefarshim that what Haggai was telling them is exactly this idea. The second Beis HaMikdash may not look like much, but it is the foundation for what's going to be the third Beis HaMikdash, and the third Beis HaMikdash is going to be eternal. So, you know, even though the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and even though the second Beis HaMikdash, when it was standing, was absent various things, but to the extent to which the second Beis HaMikdash is a building block, it's a foundation for the third Beis HaMikdash, which is going to be eternal, which is going to be everlasting, which is going to have everything that we could possibly want, which is going to usher in the Messianic era. So the second Beis, don't make light of the second Beis HaMikdash, because it may not be much by itself, but it's a prologue to a period in history which is going to be glorious. What is the divine sign that the second Beis HaMikdash is going to be everlasting? The miracles of Hanukkah. Because if you think about it, and this goes back to the Haneros Halola, which we discussed before, the miracles of Hanukkah generate a mitzvah which outlasts the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, i.e. the lighting of the menorah in our homes, and in that way creates at least something which will last the Ezras Hashem until Mashiach comes. So you put all of this together, what emerges is the following very fascinating idea. The lighting of the menorah in our homes is not primarily about just remembering a miracle of the past. The lighting of the menorah in our homes is taking the sanctity of the second Beis HaMikdash, acknowledging that that was just the beginning of what's going to be the Messianic era and the building of the third Beis HaMikdash, and our lighting the menorah in our homes serves as the link between the second Beis HaMikdash and the ultimate third Beis HaMikdash. Again, it goes back to what we said with Haneros HaLolu. Haneros HaLolu Kodeshein. These lights are holy. It's not just that we can't utilize them because we want to show that they're for the purposes of Hanukkah. No, on some level, these lights that we light in our homes is a continuation of the sanctity of the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash itself. It's as if we're bringing the Beis HaMikdash into our homes. We don't have the physical Beis HaMikdash, but we're going to perpetuate that which is associated with the Beis HaMikdash. And that's going to keep us going and keep some link between us and the Beis HaMikdash until the third Beis HaMikdash is going to be actualized and finalized, and then we'll see that there's this direct line linking the second Beis HaMikdash to the third Beis HaMikdash. Hanukkah is a holiday which gives us hope for the Messianic future. Hanukkah is not primarily about the past. Yeah, what happened in the past happened in the past. We celebrate what happened in the past. The Hanukkah reminds us that God, during the second Beis HaMikdash, was laying the groundwork for what ultimately would be the coming of Mashiach and the building of the third Beis HaMikdash. When we celebrate Hanukkah, we have an eye on the future and what's going to happen eventually. The Chassidish Sfarim writes that that's shot in a line in Tehillim. In Tehillim, in chapter Kuf Yutes, we say the words, Arachti Ner Limshichi. I have set up a light for my Moshiach. Chassidish Sfarim said that it's talking about Hanukkah. When we set up the lights of Hanukkah, our eyes are on Mashiach. Our eyes are on the ultimate building of the third Beis HaMikdash and everything that's going to come along with that. Arachti Ner Limshichi, that's the focus of what Hanukkah is all about. Bring that back to Ma'os Tzur. That's all in that one word. Le'eis Pachim Naveach Mitzar Ham Naveach. When you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, bring a slaughterhouse for the barking enemy, in other words, when you bring the end of anti-Semitism, when you bring the Messianic era, when you bring the third Beis HaMikdash, then Egmor Tishim Yizmor Chanukah Sam Mizbeach. Not that I'm going to dedicate the Mizbeach. I'm going to finish the dedicating of the Mizbeach. Because I've already started dedicating the Mizbeach. We started dedicating the Mizbeach with the second Beis HaMikdash. When we build the third Beis HaMikdash, it's just going to be a completion of the process which is already in motion now, even as we speak. Right? We are just continuing the process of preparing for Mashiach that started with the miracle of the Chashmonaim and the miracle of the oil, and we're just going to extend that all the way to the third Beis HaMikdash. Again, that's all in this one word. You just have to read one word in Ma'os Tzur. Oz Egmar the Shir Mizmar Chanukah Sam Mizbeach. I will complete the dedication of the Mizbeach when that blessed day ultimately comes. So it's a different perspective on Hanukkah than I think we're used to. We think that Hanukkah is looking backwards, but we should remind ourselves that we're not just looking backwards when it comes to Hanukkah. We're looking into the future as well, and you know, every year laying a little bit more of the groundwork and the foundation for what ultimately is going to be the coming of Mashiach to Cana.
I listened to the Shir yesterday.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. One second.
I think that's what you said.
Sounds like it should work.
Yeah, right. And then she has to change it to, if you change it, then people say,
hey,
is equal to Menachem.
Oh, one of the names from Mashiach. Very nice. Shekaiach. All right, so it's good to have a little dreidel. I guess that's what comes out.